From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, actress Chantal Cousineau came forward last year to say she was sexually harassed by director James Toback, and she helped advocate for California's new anti-harassment laws. And after 60 years, Robert Redford says he's ending his acting career with The Old Man and the Gun.
It's not like I'm going to quit. It's that I think the idea of moving on to directing and producing is probably more appealing because there's a limit to how far you can do a certain thing. And I think I had reached that point as an actor.
And a New Yorker magazine cartoonist discusses her memoir. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcast supporters include National Geographic, presenting Free Solo, a film that follows climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream of climbing El Capitan in Yosemite National Park without a rope. Free Solo, now playing at the ArcLight Hollywood.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. 1 year ago this week, the first allegations of sexual misconduct against film producer Harvey Weinstein were published in the New York Times. A couple of weeks later, 38 women who accused director James Toback of sexual assault and harassment spoke to the Los Angeles Times. Chantal Cousineau was one of them. When she was 19 years old, acting in her first film, Harvard Man, which Toback wrote and directed, Cousineau says that Toback masturbated in front of her on set. After the report about Toback was published, another 357 women contacted the paper, alleging that Toback sexually harassed or assaulted them as well. Toback denies the claims and has not been charged. In the wake of these and other accounts, the Me Too movement grew, and several bills were proposed to combat sexual harassment, assault, and discrimination right here in California. Four of them were signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown yesterday. One mandates sexual harassment training for businesses with at least five employees, and another means that non-disclosure agreements can't be used to block civil claims for sexual harassment. But Governor Brown also rejected two related bills, one that would have extended the deadline to file a harassment or discrimination complaint, and another that would have banned employers from requiring employees with sexual harassment claims to participate in private arbitration. When I spoke with Chantal Cousineau earlier today, I asked her how she's seen things change since she first came forward last year.
This moment in time has been unique from the beginning, and there's no explanation for why this moment in time had the success that it deserved, that these women deserve to be heard and to have consequences and to see, you know, people like Bill Cosby pay a price has been, I think, very healing for a lot of survivors. Myself, I've been working towards legislation reform to protect people in the future from something that happened to me, to not have it happen to other people or to have actual consequences for their actions. So I've seen quite a bit of change in the past year, but, you know, I think I can speak for a lot of survivors where we feel like we are just getting started.
Well, let's talk a little bit about these bills collectively. They're being referred to as the Take the Lead bills. What do you feel the most important things that they are addressing, and why was it important for you to become active in pushing for this legislation?
The bill that I testified for in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee last January for SB 224, and that was Senator Hannah Beth Jackson's bill for addressing the term employer for sexual harassment, because an employer for me, if you look at it technically, would be my payroll company. And I never meet anyone from a payroll company, but people that can affect my career are directors and producers and casting directors, agents. All of these people have the ability to jumpstart or kill a career. And so you make people in terms of that vulnerable to sexual harassment and to an imbalance of power. And so that one was very important to me because something of that nature happened to me early on in my career and shifted the direction of my career. I moved away from film and television and concentrated on doing television commercials and doing other things. And so that bill was close to my heart. And then there were SB 1300 and other bills that target the culture of abuse that happens, the silencing, the retaliation, and the excusing of, say, that we were calling it the one free grope. You know, you come forward, you say, I've been sexually molested or harassed in the workplace, and they say, okay, well, this is not going to be acceptable moving forward. And so you just essentially, employers had this leeway and ability to invite this ongoing harassment in the workplace.
One of the reasons, I think, that a lot of survivors of sexual assault in Hollywood are silent, and there's a number of factors, but one of them is because they feel compelled to sign an NDA, that in exchange for a financial settlement, they agreed not to comment. And SB 820 will specifically ban secret settlements or NDAs in cases of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and sex discrimination. Why do you think that's important?
Well, I think that whenever there's secrecy, it breeds vulnerability. So the non-disclosures as they were always protecting the abuser. But moving forward, I think when we shift the perspective from protecting the abusers to protecting survivors, we're going to give people the opportunity to get their voices back, to get their stories told, and to create an opportunity for educating and advocating for this to stop happening.
One of the things that I think is very important to talk about, and I'm not sure if this is something that can be addressed through legislation, is that when the charges were raised against Harvey Weinstein and Les Moonves, there was a similar story, and that was that if you said anything about them or fought off attacks, you were blacklisted. Is that still a concern that people who speak out are jeopardizing their careers?
Well, there's absolutely the risk of that happening, but this legislation is a glass ceiling break, I think, for vulnerable people in California. And I think it's going to allow for people to find their voice, stand up and say, enough, this happened to me, you know, and of course there is a concern about that. And I had to weigh that when coming forward a year ago. And I just thought, this isn't just about one story and one person and what happened to me. It's really about changing the whole playing field, leveling it out and saying, this is not how we're going to go to work anymore.
Chantal Cousineau is an actress and an advocate for a series of California bills just signed into law. Chantal, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, how a story of a real bank robber who never wanted to retire from his chosen profession became Robert Redford's last film role.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic, presenting Free Solo from the directors of Meru, hailed by critics as a stunning real-world thriller and an experience that will leave you in awe. Free Solo is the breathtaking portrait of climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream, climbing the face of the world's most famous rock, the 3,200-foot El Capitan in Yosemite National Park, without a rope. Free Solo is now playing at the ArcLight Hollywood.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the new movie, The Old Man and the Gun, Robert Redford plays a bank robber named Forrest Tucker, who, yes, has a gun, but he really uses his charm more than bullets to rob banks. In this scene, he's on a date in a diner with Jewel, played by Sissy Spacek, and in the midst of flirting, he reveals how he does it.
You have style.
I do.
Well, tell me what that is then.
My style?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's take this place. This place is not my style. But say it was a bank. And instead of that counter up there, that was really a teller's window. And that lady standing there was the teller behind the window. And you just walk in real calm and you find yourself a spot and you sit down, just like we're sitting here. And you wait and you watch. And that may take a couple of hours, might take a couple of days even, but you wait. It's gotta feel right. The timing has to feel right. And when it does feel right, you make your move. So you walk right up, look her in the eye, and you say, ma'am, this is a robbery. and you show her the gun. Like,
The Old Man and the Gun is based on the true story of Forrest Tucker, whose ability to rob banks was matched only by his uncanny ability to escape from prison, something he did many, many times. His story was told in a 2003 New Yorker article written by David Gran. It was adapted for the screen by the film's writer and director, David Lowry, who had worked with Redford on Pete's Dragon. When The Old Man and the Gun premiered at the Telluride Film Festival a month ago, I moderated a panel discussion that included Redford, Spacek, Lowry, and Gran. Here's some of that talk.
David Gran, I'm going to start with you. We have two Davids. I'm going to talk to you about your first visit with the subject of the story, how hard it was to get an audience with him, and what your impressions were of him when you first got a chance to sit down with him.
Sure. So I first read about Forrest Tucker getting arrested at age 79 after trying to rob a bank, and the police officer on the case described him as smiling and looking as if he had just come from an early bird special. I said, well, I want to talk to that guy. But he wouldn't talk. He was waiting to go through trials and sentence and then appeals, and I would write to him every 3 months, often not hearing back. And 3 months later, I would send another letter, always declined. And then after 2 years, I wrote him a letter, and he said, come on down. All his appeals had exhausted. He was alone. I think he was lonely. I went to the prison to meet him. He was very gentlemanly, as depicted in the movie. We would talk. He would tell me his life story, which remarkably checked out. And he would always ask me, each day when I would go to speak with him, he followed the same routine. He would ask me to get him a Mounds and a Dr. Pepper. And I would go over to the vending machines and bring those over to him. And on the third day of this happening, I realized that the great escape artist was, in fact, casing the joint and had really invited me down there to use me to case the joint. And so that's how it began. But I will just want to say one thing before I let all these better people speak. But they have taken the story, a true story, but they have created something of their own. And I feel very grateful to them all for creating such a beautiful movie.
Bob, I want to ask you about this article and how it came to you, because in many ways, after David Gran wrote the story, you kind of kept this story moving along in terms of it being adapted for the film that we just got to watch.
When that story came to me, it just struck a nerve with me about a bandit, a guy that robbed banks, but was so happy. And just the idea of a guy robbing banks and being happy rather than being angry and so forth, I thought, well, that's interesting. A guy that's really happy robbing banks. And so that's what first drew me to it. And then the second thing was, if it's a movie, I'd like to see it made. And I thought, this is a perfect film for David Lowry to make, but he's got to make it in his own way. And so therefore, I made myself a producer, one, to support him, because I thought he needed that support. Second was to protect him, because I thought, you know, other voices are going to come in and try to add too much to it or subtract too much to it. And I thought, no, we have to create a space where David Lowry can make the movie he wants to make and needs to make. He has a wonderful perversity. I don't mean that sexually. I mean David is wonderfully perverse. When things are going this way, suddenly things turn and go that way. And you don't quite know when that turn happened or why, but it happens, and it works. And that was something that I saw in David's work, that there was this odd sensibility he had about how to proceed with a film and how to tell a story, but it wasn't directly forward with no stops. It would stop and pause and go this way, and then it would go that way, but it would still get to the same end results. Anyway, putting all that together, I felt I was really, aside from being able to play a convict that is happy, which really excited me. I mean, I love the idea of playing a guy that robbed banks just because he loved robbing banks. And so even when he got caught, that was okay because he was going to escape because he loved escaping. So to me, that was a wonderful tone for the film that David really emphasized. And John, What are you going to say next?
I'm just going to follow you, Bob. I'll follow you wherever you lead us. David Lowery, I think picking up on what Bob said, there are so many different ways to make this movie. A lot of people would make it about Forrest's relationship with the bank tellers that he's holding up. You decided to make it about his relationship with Jewel and the police officer who is chasing him. Why was that so fundamental to the story that you wanted to tell?
You know, it's interesting because in trying to adapt the article, my first approach was to try to do something that was more journalistic. And I was trying to, you know, follow in David Grant's footsteps and talk to some of his sources. And over the course of doing that and writing many drafts of the screenplay, I mean, the first draft was like 150 pages and it was very close to like the actual events, and which were substantially different. And at the same time, they weren't. Like, you know, this captures the essence of what really happened, even though we, you know, smudge the lines here and there. But I realized I'm not really a good cops and robbers storyteller, in spite of the fact that I made several movies involving them. What interests me is like sort of the archetypes behind those roles. And so in writing this, I kept thinking like, okay, how do I make, like, what's personal to me about this? I love the idea of, you know, this bank robber who loves what he's doing and can't quit. That's real. That means a lot to me. I'm like, okay, that's a good metaphor for filmmaking right there. I also felt like, you know, we see a lot of bank robberies in movies. It's one of the tried and true tropes of cinema. I've seen several here at this festival already that are great. And I was like, what if we see a little bit of that, but then we focus on the character's relationships with the people around him? And in real life, the real Forrest Tucker did have a wife named Jewel. And so I used that as a, you know, jumping off point to build this relationship with someone who has a very complex relationship with someone who is a good bad guy.
It's a chicken and egg question. Jewel first or Sissy Spacek first?
In spite of the fact that she was based on a real person, I was kind of creating this character from scratch, and I just was trying to think, like, who, you know, I'm writing this role for Bob because I knew he was going to be in it. I was like, who would I want to see opposite Bob? And immediately I thought of Sissy and started writing it with, you know, imagining her in the character. And so I wrote the part for her, and thankfully you liked it, yes.
Thank you, David.
How do we begin to understand Jewel and what she sees in this character? What is missing in her life that makes him a good fit at that point?
A man. And I thought that Jewel must have fallen in love with him in spite of himself. She lived on a farm all by herself. She was lonely. He's a funny guy, polite, had, you know, she was lonely, and he made her laugh and took her to that great diner. It was just awesome. Wrote notes, drew me pictures. And working with Bob has been on my bucket list. And when I heard that this was going to be his last project, I thought, oh, man, I better get in line.
Bob, last question's for you. The subtitle of David Grant's article in The New Yorker is Forrest Tucker had a long career robbing banks and he wasn't willing to retire. When are we going to see you back here producing, directing? We obviously want to see you keep working. What's next? What's next for you?
Well, thanks, John. Well, as I said, never say never, but I really do believe that after a long career that I've been very happy with, starting when I was 21, is now as I approach 82, I think it's enough. It's enough. And it's not like I'm going to quit. It's that I think the idea of moving on to directing and producing is probably more appealing and probably more appropriate, because there's a limit to how far you can do a certain thing. And I think I had reached that point as an actor. And so I think that's where I am. It's not like I'm just going away forever. It's just that I leave something behind that I've been involved with for a long time, and very happily so. And moving on to another part of my life that I hope is there for me to be in.
I think the answer is definitely. David Grant, Sissy Spacek, David Lowery, Robert Redford.
That was recorded in front of a live audience at the Telluride Film Festival. The Old Man and the Gun is in theaters now. Coming up, we'll meet a woman who usually lets her New Yorker cartoons do the talking, but she opens up for the frame. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Liana Fink is a New Yorker cartoonist known for her scribbled drawing style and her sharp observations on gender and mental health. She also has a bi-monthly advice column comic in The New Yorker called Dear Pepper. When Fink spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett, she discussed her Instagram followers, her roundabout path to becoming a New Yorker cartoonist, and her illustrated memoir called Passing for Human.
I'm not a big fan of finished and beautiful art. I'm a very big fan of finished and beautiful art. I'm just not a fan of making it. I think a fine artist is patient and loves to slowly make something beautiful. And I draw my images very quickly and very small, and I photograph them and they look bigger than they are. Sometimes I'll get a fan that says, "You're so bad at drawing, it's amazing that you get your ideas across." And then I block those people and they don't know what hit them. So I guess I draw very quickly and messily. It would never occur to me that someone would think I was bad at drawing. I think I'm so good at drawing. It's like the one area where I have a lot of self-confidence. I started drawing when I was very, very young. I still wonder if that was something innate or if it was because my mom is an artist and what we did together was draw. And then the awkward time came when I realized there was a difference between just drawing funny things and making up stories and drawing and being, quote, an artist. And during that awkward period is when I went to art school and wanted to become a painter. And then very, very gradually and kind of sideways, I found my way to cartooning. Drawing and captioning didn't come naturally to me until I had this breakthrough that you don't need to write and draw at the same time. I think words and pictures can be redundant, and I realized that you could just have a picture in a box or just have a word in a box, and you could treat the word as a picture. You could put it in the middle of the box. You could treat the picture as a word. It doesn't have to be detailed. You don't have to add any detail that doesn't get a message across. And I think I realized that 2 years ago, and suddenly it fell into place. And I use the same pen always for words and pictures. I think if you don't, then it's a different vibe. I guess my station is this one corner of my couch that is now sagging. And I put my pad on the arm of the very square arm of the couch, and I kind of face it. I really like to work on subways if they're not too crowded. And I take a train to Long Island once a week, and I work on the train, which is just like the best, being like rocked in a cradle kind of feeling. I save music for when I'm very emotional, which is very often, luckily. When I'm not emotional, I listen to podcasts and radio. But I like folk music. I really love Dave Van Ronk. I listen while I'm drawing. If I'm feeling sad, it's the one thing that makes me feel good about feeling sad and kind of free and not claustrophobic.
Tell old Bill when he come home this morning.
Passing for Human is a memoir. And my story is that I'm a very weird kid who's very shy and who feels much more comfortable with objects and rocks and animals than with people. And I tell the story of how I kind of erase that part of myself very painstakingly. And then I wake up one day and I'm a person, but I'm no longer a self. And then I teach myself how to draw again. Okay. Nursery school. I'm expelled for walking on all fours like a dog. And then it shows me crawling, and then a teacher is pointing at the door and says, "Out!" A second nursery school. I tell a teacher that my dog, Pepper, taught me how to bark. I bark. Kindergarten. I attend a Montessori school run by nuns. Sister Matilda is the most homeopathic and heavy breathing of the nuns. She is my teacher. One day, and then there's a voice from offstage, and it says, "Psst, hey, Leola," which is my name in this book. "Do you want to learn a new word? Okay, write it down. B-O-N-E-R." R, and then I've written it down and everyone is laughing at me. And then this cooler girl says, give me that. And then she runs away with the thing I've written and she says, Sister Matilda, look what Leola did. Sister Matilda stops what she is doing. She looks up from the book she's been reading to kids and says, oh. She heaves up out of her chair. Her eyes are full of disappointment. I hide under a bookshelf and it shows me like zooming like a rocket into this corner she can't reach. The feelings of shock and betrayal give way to this dark knowledge, and I'm panting. Something is wrong with me. There are certain lines, and I am blind to them. I cross them. For a person like me, it will never be possible to be careful enough. And then it shows an arm reaching for me, and I'm shouting, no, to be quiet enough. And then I shout, no. That's it. I think it's okay to not be human if you have a calling. And I wonder if people who decide they have callings do so because they need a calling. And happily, I think when I draw for an audience and people tell me they relate to what I've drawn, it makes me feel a lot more human. And that's always a shock.
Streets full of people, all alone.
And that's The Frame for today. You can also listen to this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR One app. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.
A church full of singing, out of tune. Everyone's gone to the moon.